so we can be in agreement that we want to manage diabetes better, but we can't just look at the healthcare system. We have to look at all of those surrounding pieces that both got people to where they are. And it was fascinating for us because the more we were able to talk about that, the more that partners began to have their own light bulbs.
Welcome to our first episode of North Sound Voices. I'm Meg Stevenson at North Sound ACH. To get us started, we invited Becky Payne, president of the Ripple Foundation, to speak with our CEO, Liz Baxter, about what are the vital conditions for health and well-being. The Ripple Foundation first introduced the Vital Conditions Framework in 2017, and Liz and Becky are going to discuss how the vital conditions have been adopted and applied at the federal level, in community organizations, and some of the work that we're doing here in the North Sound. Let's get into it.
Hi, this is Liz Baxter, and I am with the North Sound Accountable Community of Health, or North Sound ACH. And for this podcast, I'm coming to you from the lands of the Lummi and Nooksack people up in Northwest Washington. And for those who don't know Washington State, the North Sound ACH encompasses the 100 plus miles that begin north of Seattle, go all the way to the Canadian border, extending from mountains to farmland and out into the Salish Sea. Including some communities that are separated by water from the mainland. There are 8 federally recognized tribes in our region, and they have taught us a lot about the importance of stewardship and looking at the circumstances that surround people so that we can see them as whole and valued human beings. And through the work that we've been doing, we've had a chance to work with Becky Payne, the president and CEO of the Ripple Foundation. And I'm looking forward to spending some time talking with Becky about the vital conditions for well-being. So Becky, do you think you could go ahead and like share a little bit about yourself and the foundation and the people or places that have shaped your work?
Oh, thank you so much, Liz, for inviting me. And I will start off by just saying that the work that you and your team are doing in the North Sound is an inspiration to us. So it's a real treat to be invited to talk a little bit about this with you. As you said, I'm with the Ripple Foundation. Folks may be familiar with our flagship initiative, which is Rethink Health. I joined the foundation after many years in federal public health in service at the Centers for Disease Control. But I'm a community health person by heart and by training. And at Ripple, we are a foundation that is comprised of a diverse group of passionate change makers. We pursue an ambitious vision for a future of equitable health and well-being. And we do that in a lot of different ways. The way that I find most powerful is that we work with partners like you all in the North Sound, and you join us in our ambitious vision for a future and share in our belief, as you mentioned, in the power of shared stewardship. And that really speaks to the power of people, organizations, networks, and most importantly, rooted in their communities who come together to do the work of reimagining the systems that shape our everyday lives, and to reshape them in ways that are in service of a future where all people can thrive with no exceptions. That's sort of at a high level who we are as a foundation. The way we do our work is to walk alongside, have the privilege of learning with folks on the ground, doing the real work on the front lines like you in the North Sound, and also partner with national change makers, those who are in positions to make decisions, to influence resource flows, to set recommendations, best practices. And we get to sit in this beautiful space of going back and forth between national partners and local reality and inform in both directions. So that's a little bit about the Ripple Foundation, and I'm thrilled to be with you and talk about the vital conditions.
Thanks so much. You know, when we think about data, you know, it tells us a lot, but our individual and collective experiences tell us a lot as well. And what we keep hearing is that the conditions that we're born into, the lives that we live, by far have the greatest impact on our health and well-being. And they're often described as the social determinants of health, but that language is evolving as we learn more. and centering around a framework that is moving to the vital conditions for health and well-being. And I'm wondering if you could share, Becky, just a little bit about the vital conditions and how you would describe that work.
Sure. So the vital conditions are the properties of places and institutions that all people really need in order to have equitable health and well-being. There are seven vital conditions, but before I describe them, let me tell you a little bit about how they came to be. You mentioned social determinants of health. That is a framework that those of us who live in public health and social services have come to know, rely on, used to great effect to describe this broader impact on our health and well-being that you so eloquently described. But we've also hit some limits in what that framework has allowed us to accomplish. And so back in 2017, with generous support from a national foundation, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, our Rethink Health Initiative came together with hundreds of other national and local partners who had been struggling with making progress and observing limitations about our practices of the time to be able to make the kinds of gains we needed in order to really address those social determinants of health. So the result was, you know, months of deep dialogue, shared experiences, and learning to craft a different way of talking about what was happening and what was needed. And the result was this set of vital conditions for health and well-being. It drew upon decades of research on social determinants, but also on a body of work around strategic case making. And so that really starts to shine a light on the attributes of the vital conditions that are critically important, and I would argue profoundly powerful in bringing people and communities along who may not, frankly, hold health as their most important consideration, either by vocation or by just orientation to how they think about the world. But it pulls through how we all experience day-to-day life and the way our broader context, the ecosystem in which we move through our day-to-day living and through life, shapes our ability to have the opportunity to thrive or to be trapped in cycles of struggling and suffering. So the vital conditions are seven. They include things like a thriving natural world, basic needs for health and safety, humane housing, meaningful work and wealth, lifelong learning, reliable transportation. And then the seventh, and I would argue the most special and important of all of these, is belonging and civic muscle. When you see this framework as a visual, it's literally a circle of the first six with belonging and civic muscle at the center, at the heart of the framework. And that's really important because belonging and civic muscle has an outsized impact on matters of equity. It has an outsized impact on our ability to design the other six vital conditions in a way that will have the potential to change the trajectory of the legacies we've inherited and support a more equitable approach to those other six vital conditions in the future. Now, belonging and civic muscle, I think, are becoming, they're intuitively a little more familiar to people, but I'd like to spend a minute, if it's okay with you, just describing it in more detail. Sometimes people are not sure exactly what we mean, and it's helpful to be specific. So belonging, that sense of knowing that you have a social network, that there's social support around you, that you have people who care about you, who think about you, that your contributions will be valued and that you have an outlet for those contributions. And civic muscle, that you, in those outlets, believe that the contributions that you make will have a chance of having uptake and influence, as well as having barriers removed for things, classic things that civic muscle invokes, like voting. And it's also the vital condition where we see an aspiration for creating conditions that free us from cycles of oppression, reinforce racial justice, and those kinds of things. So by building belonging and civic muscle, it is how you also build the capacities. And I would say not among community members so much. I think we see, you know, community members have long been coming together with innovative solutions to take care of each other and themselves when systems have left them on the side. I really think of belonging and civic muscle as just as important for those who hold traditional seats of power, maybe positional leadership roles, to learn how to create the space and cultivate the opportunity for community members to have meaningful input. It's only once you build those that then your design of those other six vital conditions, like I said, becomes more equitable in nature and substance. And it really shifts the conversation that communities start to have.
So you've covered a lot of ground. When I think about the pandemic, the work you've mentioned kind of happening at the federal level, like what are the opportunities that you see looking forward, and how is it going to shape the work any differently than what we've done in the past?
Yeah. So let me say just a little bit about the work at the federal level. I mentioned coming to Ripple from a role at CDC. The thing that's important, I think, for your audience is to know that last fall, in the fall of 22, the federal government released a plan for long-term equitable recovery and resilience. And that plan is work that I had the good fortune of helping to lead and get off the ground. And it brought together, now there are close to 50 of the federal agencies, so well outside of traditional health and human services, who have come together, formally reviewed and cleared, signed off on a set of 78 recommendations, all organized by this vital conditions framework. They're a set of recommendations that speak to how to fundamentally change how the federal government works, the way they interpret policy, the way they align flows of resources, be it financial resources, access to tools, training, technical assistance, data sets, the whole range of assets that the federal government holds, and how the workforce operates. So I think that's one piece I would say. That's a hopeful opportunity on the horizon. That takes time. Changing all of the federal government is a long-term aspiration, but folks in communities need to know that that exists and hold our federal partners accountable to behave in the ways that that plan is calling for. To make it a little more relevant at the local level, I would say we see a number of bright spots in communities across the country, North Sound being one of them. You have a lot of opportunity and action. We're so impressed with your commitment to think about thriving and the way you are engaging your community in the work that you're doing. We've seen bright spots in areas of Wisconsin, in Florida. We have communities across the country who are really stepping back and saying, it's one thing to say we don't want to return to the way things were operating before the pandemic, but how do we actually make that shift? And I think that that is both encouraging and incredibly fragile. And the thing that I find hopeful is that taking things like the vital conditions helps to foster a unifying conversation at the community level. And we've seen it help shift those conversations from nice to do conversations to really pragmatically laying out standards, benchmarks, ways in which we want to measure against those vital conditions. And let's very different sectors come together and say, oh, I see myself in the pursuit of humane housing, for example, and here is what I can bring to the table. Here's how I could bring resources, change decisions, make different gains and strides toward a different future. So I think it's really important to recognize that while the national narrative and even the local narrative sometimes feels very divisive and like we're all on opposite ends of a spectrum of each other, what we see happening across the country when we really observe and honor what's happening in communities is that there are numerous accounts of stewardship happening in communities every day, and we just need to pay attention and elevate those voices and share those stories much more. So again, I think it's encouraging to us that we see that the vital conditions framework is in fact resonating in communities across the country, that they are finding it useful in terms of setting the conditions to have different conversations and then helping them align their resources and make decisions to start to invest differently in how they fund programs, how they fund initiatives, how they really honor the voices of community members who have an experience with systems that needs to change fundamentally.
That's so awesome. You know, I'd like to just share a little bit about like why this resonated with North Sound. So we first learned about the kind of the vital conditions framework early in 2019. We had incorporated targeted universalism as kind of our framework for looking at equity. And we had already kind of begun this conversation about belonging and community engagement and how do we bring kind of those voices together. And so the vital conditions made sense to us, partly because it was looking at community impacts and a much broader definition of what encompasses health than anything that we'd been looking at before. But really, it was because of this notion of belonging and civic muscle sitting at the center, exactly as you described that visual. For us, we just don't think that we can actually get measurable progress toward equity and social justice without looking at all of those other conditions that kind of shape the ecosystems within which we live. And whether we're looking at our ability to survive, to recover from something like the pandemic or a once in 100-year flood, how we heal, how we thrive, like the vital conditions framework just gives us kind of a mechanism to look at that, which has been pretty awesome. When we started, we had a mission that was about focusing on improving health. And in late 2020, our board actually deleted our mission and vision and instead created a purpose, a reason for us to exist. And it says, North Sound ACH exists to create a just and inclusive culture and the necessary conditions required for all community members to thrive. And that framework of the vital conditions just kind of visually tells the story of where we're hoping that we're going with our partners. And then probably lastly, if we want to move this work forward, we actually think that we're going to get to those really good measurable health improvements. We just don't think that we can just be kind of narrowly focused on health improvements and think we're going to impact equity. We need to have that broader framework, because we just can't ignore the fact that not everybody is actually set up to lead optimal lives. There are things that get in the way of that. And if we can be thinking about that, we just will go further and, you know, do that together with our community members.
Liz, I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about why that has been so important and how it's shaping the work of your partners around the region. Because again, we find the work you all have been doing so inspiring and important to share with others.
I probably will start with an example. You know, I know that at the end of the day, we want to be able to measure well-being. We want to have a baseline. We want to see where we're doing all those improvements. And, you know, in healthcare and public health, we love measurements. Like we have really great things. So I remember talking with some primary care providers about working with people with diabetes. And their answer was pretty straightforward. It was, we just need to get everybody insurance. They have to have access to primary care. We need to pay primary care providers better. But the reality is that if the person they see in the clinic every 90 days doesn't have access to adequate refrigeration, they don't live in a place that actually has good cooling and heating, they can't afford to get their medications, they can't afford the transportation to get to their doctor's appointment, if they don't have healthy, affordable food, safe places to walk and exercise, like all of those things impact their ability to manage their hemoglobin A1C levels or anything else around diabetes.
Yes. Yes.
And so we can be in agreement that we want to manage diabetes better, but we can't just look at the healthcare system. We have to look at all of those surrounding pieces that both got people to where they are and will either help them heal, get better, you know, moving away from struggling and suffering. And it was fascinating for us because the more we were able to talk about that, the more that partners began to have their own light bulbs kind of, you know, flash on their own. And you then get hospitals that are going, wow, I wonder how we can actually impact the food system. How do we actually work in partnership with food banks or local churches and faith communities to try and get these things done? And so the belief that has been tying us together has really been, if we can be looking at the systems that surround people, then we have a greater chance of getting to those improved health outcomes. But it means that we have to look at things like the education system and what do we pay people? Like what's the safety in our communities? Things that the traditional healthcare and public health folks are not used to looking at. They're aware of it, but they haven't really felt like it was within their kind of ability to influence. But in partnership, in collaboration, there's so much more that can occur. And so, you know, we've been trying to figure out how do we kind of change our position from the federal government telling the state what to do, the state is telling us what to do, and instead turning to communities and saying, so like, what would you prioritize? What do you think would work best in your community? Who are the partners that we should be pulling together? And so from the beginning, right through now, we've been focused on partnerships, relationship building, capacity building, and finding ways for communities to actually either influence or make the decisions around what is it that's going to happen in their region, in their community, in their city, in their neighborhood, because the more that they can be engaged in that, the better the decisions will be, and there'll be better ownership and adherence
yes.
to it.
Yes, that's so powerful. So powerful. And I think there are a couple of points you made that I just want to lift up, both because to validate that we've seen them be really important in other communities, and just to keep offering encouragement. And I think the first is that measurement is important, and we've been measuring things for a long time. And so getting really clear about what matters to measure, what matters to your community members, what matters toward well-being, toward equity, toward thriving. The other thing is this perennial issue around health outcomes and disparities in health outcomes. You gave the example of diabetes, resulting in very transactional conversations about what do we do about it, and that the vital conditions framework really allowed you to set a different conversation. And I think that's also something we've observed. I observed it among the federal agencies as well when I was having those conversations. And just how important it is to validate the voice of community members, right? And you mentioned just how much that's been important. So I think those are really key and easily glossed over. And I just wanted to spend a minute reiterating those, because it's your experience locally. I think it sets you all up for success, but it's definitely part of the important ingredients we've seen in other places. So Liz, I have a question for you. One of the things that I've observed nationally and in other communities, and I really appreciate about the work you've done, is that you have used the vital conditions as a way to bring non-traditional health and public health partners to the table in really meaningful ways. But I'm curious what that has looked like and what your experience has been on that.
When we started this work, we had probably 50 partners, and they were each doing work within their own organizations to improve health. And when we adopted the framework of the vital conditions, one of the things that we said is we're only going to accomplish this if we're working in partnership and in collaboration. But seeing those six plus belonging and civic muscle in the center actually has brought more partners to the table. So we're moving, we still have the hospitals and public health, kind of the big traditional systems, but it has been wild in the last year to have almost double the number of partners who want to do this work. They see a place for them in partnership, in collaboration with those traditional organizations that has just made a difference. So there's a movement afoot, I guess, in a way, of others coming to the table and saying, I want to be a part of a more sustainable food economy. I want to be a part of finding ways to have kind of culturally appropriate foods, culturally appropriate staff. How do we do that? Whether I'm talking about discharging somebody from the hospital, or I'm talking about how I interact with my kids' school, like we're just seeing ways to create this really beautiful web of organizations who aren't just having an association with us. They're building relationship with each other, which to me is really powerful. How about you? What do you see?
That is absolutely aligned with what I see. And I have thoughts about why, since I get to see it play out in many different places. You know, when I was working in the federal interagency, we started with, I think, four agencies at the time, all formally aligned with the national response. But we snowballed to what ultimately is close to 50 agencies. And there are not 50 health agencies in the federal government. So you are necessarily talking about the arts and libraries and Small Business Administration and the Federal Reserve and, you know, really transportation, of course, and housing, of course, the agencies that have a name in one of the seven vital conditions, but also so many others. And what I have made of that is a couple of things. It is, first of all, we've all obviously lived through a pandemic. The issues and the interconnection of our economic success and viability and health, the fact that we, yes, it was a pandemic, but we are in a time of never-ending repeat crises. It is mm-hmm. the reality, given the climate crisis we're in, floods, fires, natural disasters, you name it, heaven forbid, another pandemic. It is not a matter of, okay, we got through that. It is a matter of how do we do this differently, truly do this differently going forward. And so I think that the health issues were laid bare for people who had, for lots of reasons, been able to not pay attention, not because they didn't care, but it wasn't part of their daily work or issue. So that's one. It became glaringly obvious. The second is, and I say this as a card-carrying member of the public health community, we tend to have a history of centering ourselves. One of the classic roles of public health is as a convener, but so often I think we have traditionally convened on our terms, in our turf, on our issues, and the vital conditions does not make prioritizing health a requirement for sitting at the table. And the last thing I'll say is, it really lends itself to helping to uncover for each other the ways in which partners who you may not have recognized had a role to play in a given vital condition can actually share with you what they are doing that contributes to that vital condition that you may not have found so obviously. It very intentionally sheds silos. So you don't see an organizational structure, you don't see hierarchy, you don't see agency names. It allows you to really start to have conversations where you see the overlap across organizations. And then that necessarily leads to a conversation of valuing each other versus competing with each other, because you can't deny the overlap when no one group owns one vital condition. And then the last thing I think that is so powerful is it does set benchmarks. It doesn't just say you need to have humane housing. It articulates the very specific attributes of what that looks like. So it's not just anybody's definition. It talks about adequate space. It talks about, you know, safe air. It talks about proximity to work, school, recreation, the things that gentrification, for example, can historically sometimes fracture in a community. That's part of humane housing. But those are also through lines to some of the other vital conditions. So it really elegantly portrays the complexity of the systems that we're talking about. And once you do that, you realize it's no one group's fault that we got to where we are. And it's no one group's solution set that is going to help us get to a different future.
All so powerful. You know, I think one of the other things the pandemic did for us, it showed us the importance of going to communities as opposed to having them have to come to us for solutions. And I'll join you as I'm a public health person, but I've also worked in healthcare and I've partnered with a lot of different folks. And this notion that communities where English is not the primary language needed to go to the emergency response center somewhere in order to get something that they might not even know that they needed. And to be able to invert that, where we're trying to provide the capacity for those organizations to do that for their own communities. And that's part of what has built out this network. And we see folks who never would have been considered partners going, oh my gosh, they not only see us, they value us, and they want us to lead. And all of those pieces are really critical if we're actually going to get to this equity component. So it's been a pretty amazing journey.
I would also just say, as you humbly tell that story, that none of that happens without people like you who embrace the attributes of stewardship, who really find ways to bridge differences and honor bringing people and their expertise to the table. It doesn't happen without that kind of leader, convener. And that is a skill set and a value set that is so important. And you embody that in so many ways.
Well, thank you for that. It's nice to be in an environment where we can put that out and realize there are many, many, many leaders and community members who are looking for the same thing. They just don't feel like that's been kind of a grounding framework for them. And the vital conditions has really amplified our work in that way. So it's been a great addition for us.
I'm thrilled. That's great to hear.
If there are other communities that kind of want to start examining this, are there resources that you would point them to so that they can learn more about the vital conditions and where there are other places around the country that they could kind of tap on? Because that certainly has mattered to us, just being able to talk to others kind of exploring the same work.
Yeah. Yeah. And the first thing I would say is to remember that doing this work differently does sometimes mean we need to start over together. And so the framework of vital conditions we often hear helped create shared language and common vocabulary to start the conversation in a different place. I would recommend folks learn more about Imagine Fox Cities, especially because they focus so much on belonging in the early days. And I would say that they can go to Community Commons. That's a resource that curates a lot of tools. There are specific segments on the vital conditions, but there are also resources on our website at the Ripple Foundation, so ripple.org. And I'm sure we can put all of those links into notes for your listeners. I will also just highlight that there are a couple of emerging conversations happening nationally that I think folks could pay attention to. I think for those, again, on the front lines, they sound pretty intuitive, but it's encouraging to know that they're happening at other levels. And that is this notion of what is our economy serving, and thinking more about a well-being economy, that it's not just about the pursuit of GDP, that we need to be measuring, to your point, well-being and thinking about, you know, having jobs and an economy that is in service of more than just dollars and cents, that if we're putting our time and our effort into jobs, that we are making sure that it's an economy that is serving our well-being. And so really interrogating that. But I think that really, I would encourage folks to connect back with you and your team. You have a lot of expertise that I know it's hard to see when you're locally looking at yourselves, but you all have done a lot of thinking around this, and I think you are a tremendous resource. And we've got some other articles that help people make sense of the difference between the social determinants of health and vital conditions and honors, that they're both vitally important and they can really work in service of each other.
Becky, just, you know, thank you so much. It's been so valuable to have you, you know, share that national perspective and what you're seeing across the country as we get moving. So thank you for your time. Thanks for the listeners who want to jump in, and I hope that we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the North Sound Voices podcast. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast so you don't miss out on our latest episodes. You can also follow us on social media at North Sound ACH on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. This podcast is produced by North Sound ACH with Meg Stevenson, Natalie Esparza, Liz Baxter, and Stacey Wegley. Our music is by Die Hard Productions.